It's the Labor Co-op edition of Radio Free Thinker. This week, a promise of prosperity for all, a jobless society, Uber and taxi redux, the value of unions, and much, much more. Let's begin episode 356.
It's time for Radio Free Thinker, the show that applies skepticism and critical thinking to everyday issues. The place where reason and reality cross swords, politics, religion, economics, and of course, science. Now let's get ready to be skeptical.
The cosmos is also within us. We're made of sparks. We are away. The cosmos can know itself.
Across the sea of space, the stars are other suns.
We have traveled this way before, and there is much to be learned.
Hello and welcome. Tis I, Don, your skeptical philosopher and political scientist. This week we start with a progressive faith sermon by Reverend Dr. Ray. Though our world is completely transformed in the span of a century, our attitudes towards labor are still locked in a more primitive era of scarcity. The real modern world is still waiting to be born, when we all afford all human beings a decent way of living without fear of homelessness or hunger. Let's listen and learn.
The practice of tipping a waiter or waitress was originally a European idea, and it began to find its way across the ocean in the mid-1850s, and Americans didn't like it. In fact, there were city governments and states that were outlawing tipping. That changed after the Civil War, when all the slaves were freed and the train industry was growing, and they wanted to hire all these Pullman porters, and the train company did not want to pay these former slaves any salary at all. They wanted them to live off the tips they got as a Pullman porter. So from 1865 to 2016, the salary for service workers in the food industry has risen all the way from zero to $2.13 as the federal minimum. In Missouri, we will not tolerate that kind of abuse, and so tipped workers can be hired for $3.82 an hour. No sense taking advantage of folks, is there? Most restaurant servers are female, and because they are working for tips, they often are put in a position of just enduring whatever harassment or abuse comes their way in order to be given enough tips to live on it, which is one annoying thing, but I have to say, as bad as that is, for me it's not the whole picture. The restaurant closest to my home is owned by the billionaire O'Reilly family, and I am expected to pay their labor costs by tipping the staff who are busting their butts making more money for the O'Reillys. Since I pay attention to labor issues, I have to admit it gets harder and harder for me to eat out. The Metropolitan Grill, the Metropolitan Farmer, Barley, Wheat, and Rye, the Great American Taco Company that has a couple of locations in Springfield are all owned by a right-wing guy who makes sure that none of his servers get enough hours to qualify for health insurance. And I would starve to death before I would give that heartless man another dollar. The same goes for the Obamacare, anti-Obamacare owner of Papa John's Pizza, or for that matter, the big game hunter that owns Jimmy John's. All of which helped to inspire me to start trying to grow a lot of my own food in my backyard, because there's just fewer and fewer people that I want to support by paying them a profit for abusing their workers. The most wealthy people in America are the owners of Walmart, and they assiduously control their labor force to shift the burden of paying them onto the taxpayers in this country who have to support the public housing, Medicaid, SNAP, and other social programs Walmart employees need to survive. In fact, in new employee orientation, they oftentimes will give education in how to sign up for these government benefits that they will qualify for by working for Walmart. Even the local families who own our McDonald's, Wendy's, Panera, and other fast food restaurants are all multimillionaires paying employees in a way that shifts the burden of their support onto social welfare programs. Our system rewards billionaires and millionaires for keeping their workers in poverty. Many of these people absolutely cannot see that they would be better citizens. They would be better people. Or if they're religious, they would be better Jews, Christians, Muslims, Buddhists, or Hindus if they would temper their desire for profits with some desire to create better paying jobs for their employees. What I find mystifying is that it's been demonstrated for the past decade, study done through Harvard's business school, that the employment model used by Costco that pays higher salaries, has better health care benefits and retirement programs for their workers, that they are basically in head-to-head competition with Sam's and they make more profit than Sam's does, their chief rival. Now, the owners of Sam's and Walmart are not stupid. They have seen these studies. They know it is true. But somehow they've reached a point where they would actually rather make a little less money if it allows them to abuse their millions of employees a little bit more. Am I stretching too far to say that they take some personal gratification by making millions of employees more miserable, forcing them to live in poverty, to keep them dependent on food stamps and public housing? There are people who will not do the right thing until they are forced to do the right thing. We did not just morally grow our way out of slavery or indentured servanthood or child labor. We legislated them out of existence because there are things a society will not do on its own just because it's right. Labor Day in America has a bit of a dubious beginning and a very checkered past. Grover Cleveland signed the federal holiday into law just days after striking Pullman workers had been forced back to work for lower wages at the point of guns held by American soldiers. We literally deployed the military to force people to go to work for less money than they had been being paid. Labor Day was not so much to honor the social contributions of labor unions as it was a concession to prevent a violent response to the way that the Pullman strike was ended. The myth that we are all spoon-fed in public schools during our youth was that European settlers came to these shores to escape the crushing feudalism of monarchy and the religious oppression that the working class had suffered in England and Europe. But before the first century of this American experiment had ended, it looked like the shoe was on the other foot. There was more religious freedom, less of a class society, and more general welfare in Europe, and they had all managed to end the institution of slavery without a war. We want to say that we are the greatest nation on earth. We say that we cherish liberty and freedom, and certainly we all applaud those values, and I wish with all my heart that they were actually a part of the American experience for everyone. But you do not have liberty or freedom when employers are allowed to employ millions of Americans for wages that rob them of their liberty and their freedom.
Amen.
Unless you mean by liberty and freedom is that you are free to be homeless if you wish, you have the liberty to starve to death if you choose to do so, but you don't have liberty and freedom to live like a human being with dignity by working for what we call a minimum wage. It would be different if we were facing real scarcity in the 21st century, if we simply couldn't grow enough food, build enough houses, or hire enough doctors and nurses to care for our needs. But the problem is not scarcity of resources. The problem is the scarcity of morality. And for that poverty of character, there is no further excuse. In the single lifespan of my parents, Our civilization moved from mule-drawn plows, horse-drawn carriages, outhouses, coal lamps, wood-burning stoves, and exposure to early death from a myriad of infections and diseases into the age of refrigerators, electric lights, cars, telephones, TV, spaceflight, antibiotics, supermarkets, commercial flight, computers, cell phones, smartphones, the internet, and Andy's frozen custard. And yet our attitude towards labor and fair wages is more primitive than it was in the time of Franklin Roosevelt and Harry Truman. When it comes to ethics, we're still living in a world threatened by pneumonia and lit with a smoking coal oil lamp. America has so much potential to create a free, just, and liberated society, and so little will to do it that it's hard not to be discouraged, except for this one thing. I still have faith that the modern world is just waiting to be born. The potential is there. It is as if you can feel the birth pangs in the Arab Spring, in the Occupy Wall Street movement, in the Bernie Revolution, and to some degree, even in the Brexit vote, in our Native American brothers and sisters standing up against an environmentally stupid pipeline, and an African American football player who sits down when his masters tell him to stand up. To quote a famous Monty Python skit, not really dead yet. In fact, the real modern world is just now waiting to be born.
Have you ever noticed that a lot of talk about how robots will one day take over more and more of our tasks? Just what happens when they do all the work? The idea of a jobless society is taken up in this interview. Let's listen and learn.
John Nichols and Robert McChesney have been working together for some time, writing prescient critiques of the state of the media, the ability of billionaires to buy our elections, and much more. Their new book, People Get Ready, The Fight Against a Jobless Economy and a Citizenless Democracy, is one they've called their most important yet. Recently, I hosted an event in New York with John Nichols, who is also the author on his own of Uprising, How Wisconsin Renewed the Politics of Protest from Madison to Wall Street, to discuss the book, The Role of Technology in the Changing Shape of Work, and what we can do to make sure that our economic and political futures are equitable and just. This is an edited selection from that conversation.
So I think we're going to start off by, John just told me that he could summarize his book in a minute. I don't think I'm going to hold him to 1 minute, but we're going to let you do a little rundown about what's in this book, and then I will ask you some very difficult questions about it.
So our previous books that Bob and I wrote dealt with media and democracy, and got a very respectful and pleasant reception in the United States. And they also, were accepted by academia and blah, blah, blah. But weirdly enough, in Europe, people actually thought this might be relevant to policymaking. Unlike in America, where it's just like, oh, it's interesting to talk about media and democracy. Those are esoteric, fascinating topics. But in Europe, they actually thought, oh, this is important. So we started getting invited to go to these incredible international conferences. And I want to tell you, the mineral water is fabulous, and everybody wears these really great suits, and there's a lot of security and swans. And so we're at these conferences, and we're talking about the future, and they would let me say a few things about democracy or media or something. And, you know, I would then, of course, having said my piece, which, you know, was greeted politely, sit back and listen to everyone else. And we were with the CEOs of major companies. We were with heads of think tanks, really the people who are at the heart of debates about the future of not just this planet, but the people who live on it, what they will do for a living, how they will experience what comes next. And what fascinated me was they were all talking about how many jobs they were going to eliminate. And they actually had these fabulous screens where they would talk about whole industries, and they would flash up and say, well, today, to build a car, you would need this many people. But as we move through the next stages of digital progress, we will be able to build that car with a handful of robots and one guy doing this. And then they were talking about, It used to take 60 people to bring a ship into a port. It can now be done by one guy pressing a button. And they kept talking. It's interesting. It was always a guy. But the bottom line was we kept eliminating. And I thought to myself, this is a very robust conversation. And then I would go to these other conferences. And it was this robust conversation. It was this incredibly engaged, focused conversation about a future where there were fewer and fewer jobs and where the jobs that remained were sounded like really not so great. Like you got to like take your private car and troll around the streets of big cities looking to see if anybody wanted to pay you to give them a ride or take an apartment in your, I know this is unimaginable that this could happen, but take an apartment, you know, and like maybe you have a room in your apartment, you can rent it out to people who are like traveling to the town. And it's like all these things of, you know, like where you would cobble together a life off the scraps of what, you know, once was a society. And I thought to myself, this is interesting to me because I cover politics in America and I watch how the media covers issues. I watch what politicians say. And I'm struck by the fact that nobody is talking about this. Like our political, this is like a really big deal, right? I mean, sort of like a jobless future or maybe not jobless, but really like not so great job future and a lot of other problems. And nobody's talking about it. And I thought, you know, this might be a good idea for a book. And then I came back. Bob and I were working on another book and I started talking to him about it. And he said, this is so weird. I was just in Norway doing a conference and that's all anybody was talking about. And so long story being short, we scrapped the book we were working on and we decided to write a book about the danger of a jobless economy and a citizenless future. It's not that we fear technology. We love technology. We are marinated in it. We use it all the time. However, what we fear is that our technological future and our digital and automation changes that will take place, that are taking place, that they will be handed down to us from on high by the CEOs of multinational corporations, by the heads of think tanks, and by tech utopians who fantasize that somehow we're going to be able to work this all out by developing a new app. There isn't an app to get us out of this thing. This is the bottom line reality. And it is a pure fantasy to believe that in a capitalist society, you would develop technologies that allow you to eliminate labor and then come up with some new way to create more jobs. That's not going to happen. It's illogical. And if we recognize that, then we get to the core of the book, the simplest core. And that is, why don't we say, cool, that's excellent. The technology was supposed to free us from drudgery. It was supposed to give us better, wholer, more wonderful lives. That's what Tesla promised. That's what Einstein promised. That's what Edison promised. Nobody who ever was inventing stuff said, oh, this is going to really make your future awful. No, they said it's going to make your life better. And what we suggest is that the change is coming. We're in the thick of it right now. It's already happening. And it is time for us to move up to that table, push some of these CEOs and think tank folks and tech utopians aside, put our chair right there. And let's just say, you know, our boots are a little muddy and our hands are maybe a little dirty, but let's put them down on the table and say, you know what? I would like to be a part of this discussion. I would like to be a part of deciding what kind of future I have. And if there's a great deal of wealth and progress and benefit to come from technological progress, I want a piece of the action. And so that's what we say. People get ready. Come on. Just, there is a change coming. This train's coming through. You better get on board. But don't get on board as a passenger. Let's elbow our way up front and become the engineers.
We'll return after this break.
Hey there.
Barev.
We're the Armenian Students Association, and we're here to bring together everyone,
Armenians and non-Armenians,
who are interested in learning about the Armenian culture here at UBC.
Find us on Facebook at ASAUBC to stay up to date. We look forward to seeing you at our future events.
You're listening to Radio Freethinker on 101.9 FM CITR, your fully employed and completely democratic skeptical radio show. And we're back. Continue with our theme. The next clip is from Professor Robert Wolf on how the, quote, Uber revolution is really just a repeat of earlier advent of taxi industry. And by ignoring lessons learned then, we risk damaging society and people yet again. Let's listen and learn.
14,000 drivers for the car services Uber and Lyft here in New York City have signed cards that they wish to be represented by the Transit Workers Union here in the United States and in New York City. This is a sign that is extremely important. It's a sign that the fantasy, which is all it ever was, that these new car services like Uber, like Lyft, and there are others, were some kind of technological event, is put to rest. They weren't technological events. True, they were using software and apps in a new way that was somewhat different from the dispatching done by cab companies for decades before. But they weren't really about the new technology, since the cab companies have now adopted that kind of technology and are using it pretty much themselves. What it was always about was an attempt to get around trade unions. So I want to recoup that history so no one makes the mistake again. In the early days of cab companies, there was a problem. Everybody got involved in the cab business. It was easy. You just had to know how to have how to get a driver's license and drive a car, and ipso facto, you could offer taxi cab services. And many people did. It was a chaotic industry full of little individual and not so little group activities. Not much care was taken who the driver was, how competent he or she might be, what happened if there was an accident, etc. So pretty quickly, complaints began to rise. Riders were injured. Riders didn't like the attitudes of the driver. Driver was unable to manage the job real well, etc., etc. And then there was gouging of prices, etc. So guess what happened? Driving became difficult. Companies that had a lot of drivers began to squeeze the drivers, and the drivers reacted by forming unions. This story is as old as capitalism has been around. The workers, to defend themselves, formed the union. And the customers, to defend themselves, demanded that the government get involved because they were taking too many risks riding in these cabs that the driver may not have been trained enough, there may not have been insurance in the event that there was an accident, etc., etc. Make a long story short, the government got involved to make sure that taxi cab riding was safe for the public. And the way they did that was to pass a whole lot of rules. The driver had to be vetted. The car had to be insured. There had to be all kinds of inspections to make sure the car was safe to drive in, etc., etc. And it was also at that point that the unions emerged and put pressure on the government to make sure that the union could organize these workers, could approach them and say, look, if you would rather be protected by a union, we're here, you can do it. And a deal was struck, as happens so often, a deal between the workers and their union and the companies running the cabs and the government. And here's what was done. A price was established for a taxi ride, a price that was sufficient for the company to make a profit, for the workers to earn a decent living and to have proper benefits, and for the public to have the assurance that the ride was safe, the driver was properly trained, etc. And so it was for decades. This worked out perfectly well. What Uber and Lyft represent is an attempt to get away from this arrangement. They would offer the ride more cheaply. They would offer it under different circumstances. And how were they able to do that? Because they had the new app and the new technology? Not at all. That didn't make much of a difference. What they had was drivers who were not part of a union, at least not yet, and whom they could treat in that manner, cutting their wages, cutting their benefits. And they weren't governed by the government's rules because they weren't technically a taxi company. They were a riding service. So their drivers, Who knows how much training they got? Who knew whether they had proper insurance? And all that has happened since they began is they've made a lot of money. They've made high profits because they don't pay their drivers very well, because they don't have to pay the costs of what the government regulations demand of the taxis, etc., etc. And now that's changing. Why? Because people are having problems with Uber and Lyft. What problems? The very problems they had with taxis way back when. And the end result is governments are getting more involved in regulating the Uber-Lyft type of service, and the workers are joining unions, like the 14,000 in New York joining the ATU this last few weeks. And I just wanted to make sure everybody understood how this old capitalist story is being rerun in what claims to be a new industry, a gig economy, and all the other fancy phrases.
Our next clip is about how important unions are for non-union workers and how they set the floor for which all labor is measured. Let's listen and learn.
Okay, I mentioned unions and wages. This is a brilliant piece. The Economic Policy Institute issued a report. It was written by Jake Rosenfeld, Patrick Dennis, and Jennifer Laird. And it's titled, Union Decline Lowers Wages of Non-Union Workers. The overlooked reason why wages are stuck and inequality is growing. And they point out pay for private sector workers in the last 35 years hasn't budged, right? And you know, I talk about this a lot. This is what we're seeing here is Reaganomics. And it was Reagan's war on unions, which he declared in the first couple of weeks of his presidency when he busted PATCO. In fact, for men in the private sector who lack a college degree and do not belong to a labor union, real wages today are substantially lower than they were in the late 70s before Reagan. I added the before Reagan part. And then they talk about in the debates over the causes of wage stagnation, the decline in union power has not received nearly as much attention as globalization, technological change, and the slowdown in Americans' educational attainment. By the way, keep in mind, Donald Trump is basing most of his campaign on the fact that wages have been stagnant for 35 years, and he's saying it's because of Mexico, it's because of China, it's because of our trade deals. Well, to some extent it is, but it's also, and in fact, according to these guys at the Economic Policy Institute, largely because of the loss of unions in the United States, which is, you know, the cornerstone of Reaganism. Destroy the unions, you destroy the funding mechanism for the Democratic Party, and they'll have to start getting in bed with banksters, which is exactly what happened. So anyhow, they and so you would think that, you know, if Trump really wants to restore the American dream and bring back the American prosperity we had in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, that he would be saying, hey, we need to go back to 35% unionization instead of the 6 or 7% we have right now in the private sector. Of course, he's not talking like that because he's a Republican. I mean, no, as I just heard Harry Truman on this. So here are the key findings of the report. One. For non-union private sector men, weekly wages would be an estimated 5% higher in 2013. This is the last year that they had numbers for that they could really crunch well. But it's, you know, you can extrapolate it to today. For non-union private sector men, weekly wages would be an estimated 5% higher in 2013 if private sector union density remained at its 1979 level. For a year-round work, in other words, union density, number of people who are union members in the workforce. For a year-round worker, this translates to an annual wage loss of $2,700. For the 40 million non-union private sector men, the loss is equivalent to $2.1 billion fewer dollars in weekly paychecks, which represents an annual wage loss of $109 billion, just slightly more than the net wealth of the Koch brothers. I added, for non-union private sector men without a bachelor's degree or more education, non-college graduates, weekly wages would be an estimated 8% higher in 2013 if union density remained at its 1979 levels. For a year-round worker, this translates into an annual wage loss of over $3,000. And they continue through the list. You know, it's taking out these various slices of people. The degree of non-union wage decline reflects how much unionization has declined since 1979 among private sector men by two-thirds, from 34% to 10%. That 10% includes government employees. Among women, by more than one-third, from 16 to 6%. And especially among non-college degree men, by more than two-thirds, from 38 to 11%. As unions have receded from the private sector, their effect on the wages of non-members' percent of unionization has declined. And they go through more of the details and all the stuff, but you know, this is something I have been pointing out since we started this program 13 years ago, that for every good union job in an economy, there's always a parallel non-union job that basically has the same wages and benefits because the unions set the floor. And as you destroy the unions, you destroy the floor. And now working people in the United States are basically falling through the floor.
Next, we have Dr. Wolf again about the importance of putting social and economic needs as part of our economic priorities. Let's listen and learn.
Let's suppose we had a rational society that decided not only what it wanted to have produced, goods and services, housing, food, clothing, transportation, entertainment, whatever, but also took ecological, environmental considerations seriously. Not to further damage the ozone layer, not to further contribute to global warming, not to damage the earth, the water, the air, all of that that you all know very well, then it might be decided, democratically, one hopes, to put to the mass of people the question, can we find ways to be more respectful, to be better able to preserve the natural environment we depend on than we have been, and what are the implications for work? And such a deliberation could decide, yes, we can get by very well with much less stuff. And that will preserve our energy resources. It will preserve the health and well-being of our natural environment. And it has another benefit. If we produce less and use up less of our earth, we will also therefore have to work less. And this would become appealing to the American people if they knew that the benefit of ecological consciousness would include sharing more leisure. Let me explain very concretely. In the United States, and indeed in many parts of the world that are copying the United States, we move people around by means of private automobiles to an extraordinary extent. And private automobiles are notorious for the deaths and injuries they cause in traffic accidents, for the enormous waste of energy that is involved in moving one person in one vehicle as opposed to 20, 30, or 40 people in a bus or a train, etc. The pollution caused by the private automobile far exceeds what public transportation would provide. So let's see. Were we to decide to save on the energy waste and the pollution and the death and injury that the private automobile mode of transportation entails, and if we were to move instead to beautiful, well-prepared, high-quality, frequent public transportation in all the urban and suburban areas where most people in most advanced countries now live, we would be able to give everybody several hours of week less work. We wouldn't be making those cars anymore because we wouldn't need them. We would be making, and it takes many fewer hours, we would be making trains and buses and vans, instead. And if that, here we go now, if that cut in the production of automobiles was accomplished by sharing the benefit that we don't need to spend umpteen million hours producing the cars we no longer rely on, if that were shared, then the mass of people would be able, by the same decision, to save on the waste of energy involved in the car, to save on the death and injury involved in a car-based transportation system, to save on the pollution of air and water that wasteful car production has always meant, and at the same time give themselves fewer hours of labor, which would be shared across all industries and not just the automobile. Therefore, everybody would continue to work. They'd have less hours. And you know something? Because of the savings in money from going from a private to a public transportation system, even the fact that the fewer hours you worked meant you got a little bit less pay, it wouldn't impact your standard of living, because if you think about it, you would be saving a fortune moving to high-quality, mass-produced, mass transportation from the enormous expenses of your private car with its private insurance and its private excessive fueling, etc., etc. Our dependence on oil, all of it could be changed. There are other examples. Group housing is much cheaper than individual housing. What about that? And the savings in labor that could be shared by everybody if we understood the wisdom, the ethics, and the democratic appeal of sharing the work, just like we should share the unemployment if it happens. Substituting collective child care for the individual child care we now rely on in this country, at least. Providing subsidized, inexpensive, healthy, publicly provided food for people to pick up on their way home rather than spending time having lots of little producers making lots of little food along the way, duplicating the effort needlessly and inefficiently. The examples are legion. I don't want to get lost in the specifics. I want the big point to be made. In a rational society, here's how the economic system would be planned. Figure out how much stuff we as a society want. Take into account our needs, our desires, our pleasures. Take account of the economic and the ecological environment we're in. Figure out how many hours of work it would take to produce the goods and services that reflect our respect for our individual needs and wants and our collective dependence on nature. And then divide the work equally among all the able-bodied adults so we all participate in doing the work that we all together decided we as a community want. That's a better way. It's a more rational way. What it doesn't allow for is a tiny group of people to make decisions based on their own profits, even if they flaunt the needs and desires of a democratic society. The most egregious example is how I'll end this conversation. Once upon a time, clothing in the United States, for example, was largely made in the United States. The shirt, the pants, the shoes, the socks you wore were produced a few miles from where you purchased them. That means that very little energy was wasted and very little pollution resulted from moving clothing from the producer to the consumer. 50 years ago, American capitalist enterprises involved in the production of clothing made a decision driven by profitability. They decided it was more profitable to move to China or Bangladesh or Mexico or Africa, or in any case, far away in most cases. China is the prime example. They decided that they could make more money because they could pay Chinese workers a small fraction of what they had come to need to pay American workers, that they could find exemptions for all kinds of expenses that they had here, but that they could avoid in China or Bangladesh or Vietnam or Pakistan or wherever. They left because the profit motive of capitalism drove them to do that. So now, as you all know, your pants, your shirts, and most everything you wear comes from places thousands and thousands of miles away. To cover all of that mileage, energy has to be used to fuel the ships, the trucks, the trains, the planes that bring that all to you. And the burning of that energy leads to pollution of the air and the water. Nobody cared about that for decades, as people got sick, as people who didn't need to died. We were all victims, and I'm not just talking about those who lost their jobs in the clothing industry. They suffered too. But everybody suffered, and the environment suffered, because private profit-driven capitalism works that way. My point is simple. To avoid that kind of economic development, profitable for the few, a disaster for the many and for nature itself, we need to change the way we make decisions and what the bases and goals of our decisions are. Sharing unemployment is not only something we should do as we cope with the irrational instability of capitalism. It's also a way to understand how we can win the majority of our fellow citizens to a program to make ecological preservation a central part of our political future. Because we can go to the people and say, environmental protection is not a threat to your job. Not protecting it is a threat. Going in that direction, finding ways to produce less and to use up less of our natural resources, is also a way to increase leisure as we share, for the first time really, the benefits of a more rational economic system.
We'll return after this break.
Stressed lately? UBC Yoga Club is here to offer you a peace of mind. Come out to any of our 17 weekly classes running 7 days a week, ranging from 8 a.m. to 7 p.m. We have a class to accommodate your needs and abilities. Check us out at ubcyogaclub.com.
Listening to Radio Freethinker on 101.9 FM Vancouver, your union-supporting radio broadcast. And we're back. Last, we have part four of a five-part interview with Dr. Elperovitz, professor of political economy at the University of Maryland and co-founder of the Democracy Collective. Here he tells us of the experience of Spain's Mondragon, the world's largest workers' co-op, shows that the workers' ownership can go to scale, but on their own, co-ops will not transform society or the economy. Let's listen and learn.
Welcome back to the Real News Network. I'm Paul Jay in Baltimore. This is Reality Asserts Itself. We're continuing our series of interviews with Gar Alperovitz, and Gar now joins us in the studio. Again, Gar is the Lionel R. Bauman Professor of Political Economy at the University of Maryland, co-founder of the Democracy Collaborative. His most recent book is What Then Must We Do? Straight Talk About the Next American Revolution. Thanks for joining us again.
Thanks, sir.
So, Gar, you've talked a lot about the importance of workers' co-ops, and probably the most outstanding, largest, gone-to-scale version of workers' co-op is Mondragon in Spain. It was a multi-billion dollar business with different divisions and all kinds of production. And for a lot of people, people were saying, well, this is kind of the future, and that this is the way to transform the society. In spite of all success, Mondragon did not transform Spanish society, economy, or politics. And then more recently, the Fagor division, which does electronics, washing machines, and dishwashers and such, essentially has gone bankrupt because they couldn't compete with cheaper Chinese products and the collapsing Spanish economy and such. So talk about, you know, what we can learn from Mondragon as a positive, but also the limits of building workers' co-ops in terms of bigger transformation.
Yep, it's a very important point. I just did an article on this subject because it raises a very important strategic issue for thinking about how we want to organize our own economy. Mondragon is, you know, 80,000 workers involved in maybe 85 co-ops, or depends how you count them. And it's been very successful, very participatory. This is the plus side. Wages, top to bottom, the ratio in 80% of them were 6-1. American corporations, it's 250-300-1, top to bottom. So very democratic and democratic participation. In a few of the larger ones, it was slightly worse, 9-1, but 8-1. So it's a very democratic distribution of income compared with the corporate system, and more democratic participation. So there's a lot to learn. On the other hand, they are operating in the global market. They're operating in the Spanish market, and they are totally dependent on the conditions of capitalism in those markets. And as we've just seen, one of the big, big units collapsed. And the other units, usually they try to support each other. The other units couldn't.
Well, even in the collapse, Mondragon's done something no big capitalist firm would do, which is they were using their own insurance company to guarantee wages for the laid off workers for 2 years, and they're going to try to find other jobs for them.
Absolutely.
So even at that level, it's better than what the alternative
Absolutely.
Would
have been. Absolutely, and no one should be. It's a very important, very positive experiment, and it's within limits because it's dependent upon the world market, and also the vicissitudes of capitalism, and so it's got difficulties. So when you actually ask what ought to be done with co-ops or things like Mondragon, they could be part of the new economy. I think that's certain. But if you get to significant scale, and Mondragon and Fagor, that division, were large scale, you're really up against either the economy has a certain planning capacity, or you're up against the markets and you're faced with what's happened to them. So for instance, next time General Motors collapses, and I think there will be a next time in Chrysler, we just took them over. The government bailed out that big company, made it, socialized it, became a nationally owned government company. U.S. taxpayers owned it. What we ought to be doing, thinking about this model, is building mass transit, high-speed rail, turning that into a transportation company with taxpayer money that's going to pay for it anyway. That's what we're doing now. And then begin using our planning for transportation as a society, the government, to begin saying, okay, this is how many roads, this is how many rails we really ought to have, moving away from all the highway system, moving away from flights as well. The rails are much more efficient than flights if you had them, and supporting cities by having adequate transportation, where now the airlines are cutting out of cities like Cincinnati. The whole city is going to go down. We ought to have a transportation plan. That will tell you how many rails and how many buses and how many trains you need, and then you produce to the plan, and you have stability because you have a plan. Now, I don't think the entire economy ought to be planned, but major segments of it can be planned and solve the problem of companies facing unemployment like Fagor.
Well, major sectors of the economy are already planned.
Yes.
It's just their own privately. Like, probably maybe the most brilliant piece of planning and the largest private employer in the country is Walmart.
Yep.
Walmart is an incredibly planned economy. It's just owned privately, and there's no, you know, it's planned in a way that workers are paid terrible wages. But if you had, for example, a publicly owned Walmart that paid decent wages, it would have an enormous ripple effect throughout the whole economy.
That's right. And the planning takes place in every major corporation.
I mean, you take a tube of toothpaste off a Walmart shelf, they know and somewhere in Asia another tube of toothpaste has to be produced.
So I hope
can't get more planned than that.
Right. I hope we can move that back and have the United States beginning to do that rather than Asia. Yeah, that's a whole other set of questions. But planning takes place. We know how to do that. Now, there is a whole question about democratic planning, which means that the society has to produce a democratic capacity. Right now, the corporations control a lot of the politics of this. So when you say planning is necessary, and it is necessary to deal with Mondragon, Fagor, these problems we're talking about, to deal with transportation, then you're also saying we need a democratic society, because otherwise the corporations will control the national planning. So you're talking about really changing the whole nature of the substructure of the system.
We're talking about who has power.
Who has power, because the planning system is going to be controlled by somebody. And it's either the corporations or we have to. And to say that is to say, you want to play this game about changing the system? The chips are 3 decades of your life. We're talking about big time, build from the bottom, begin to reshape from the neighborhood, from the worker-owned co-ops, from the cities. Some of the really interesting things that you're doing here in Baltimore, beginning to build up knowledge, ideas, experiments, a program that actually is practical, and look at it as a 30-year strike, as a strategy at least, to begin to deal with the power of this system. So that's the name of the game.
I mean, it flows from the idea that concentration of ownership gives rise to concentration of political power.
Yes.
So you need to change the way things are owned.
That's the central element, systems. You know, in feudalism, it was land. Who owned the land had the power. Capitalism, who owns the capital has the power. State socialism, there was a form where the state controlled it, and it could have been democratized.
It was another form of too much concentration
of
ownership, because the party winds up controlling the state, so the party now has the concentration of ownership, and you wind up with the same kind of, similar kind of problem. I can't say same kind, but a similar kind of problem.
Which tells you that the model that we want to build has to have democratized ownership, but democratized in a way that builds from the bottom up, so that the concentrations of power are not overly concentrated, that the terms are whether appropriate to the scale. So little co-ops in some places, city-owned in other places, neighborhood-owned in other places.
State-owned.
Regional, the Tennessee Valley Authority, was designed in the initial state as a way to do ecology of the river and power. It got taken over.
But there will still be some things of
absolutely.
At a national scale,
and then
which
there's
are
national.
Going to have to be nationally
absolutely.
Owned.
And then there's national. So, but again, the principle, I call it a pluralist commonwealth. Pluralist commonwealth. The principles, you always stay at the lowest level necessary and only go up if you have to, so that you keep it closer to democratic processes. So that's the kind of vision that at least we've been trying to develop and begin to get, you know, and get very real about it in terms of what's on the ground. There are places around the country where almost everything we're talking about is already being done in one form or another. It's practical. And
what
if it isn't
what are
practical,
some of the best examples?
The best examples are, for instance, in Cleveland. There's an extremely interesting, and many other places are doing something like this. There's an extremely interesting neighborhood, is 40,000 people, mostly black, unemployment 40%, average family income 18,000, really beaten up neighborhood. Well, there's a complex...
Average family income, 18,000?
18,000, yeah. In that neighborhood, there's a community-wide structure, nonprofit corporation, and worker-owned cooperatives, which are subordinate to it, but work together. So they kick in a little bit of profit in order to start new ones. And they, not just little ones, there is the largest urban greenhouse in the United States is one of these things. 3 million heads of lettuce a year. That's the scale we're talking about. Not that people think of co-ops, they think little tiny things. There's a huge industrial scale laundry. There's a different co-op that it's very green. It uses about a third of the water and a third of the heat. And then there's other being built each year. But the point is that some of the money goes to build the neighborhood, some of it goes to start new co-ops, and then they use the purchasing power of universities and hospitals in that area. So Case Western Reserve University, the Cleveland Clinic, University Hospitals are right in this poor neighborhood. They buy $3 billion, with a B, dollars in goods and services, plus the salaries, plus their construction, just what they buy. None of it from this neighborhood beforehand. But now they're beginning to shift some of it. A lot of public money there, too. Medicare, Medicaid, education money, taxpayer money. They're beginning to shift it to this purchasing to help rebuild the neighborhood. That's a really interesting model because it has very decentralized ownership, but you're using essentially quasi-public resources to help do it. And many other cities are waking up to the fact they've got the same situation and they can do it. So Atlanta's now beginning to do it. There are two or three going to be in the Washington, D.C. area, several around the country beginning to see you can begin putting down these principles, these practices, practically. Interesting other thing about this, which is very important, particularly for liberals and the left to think about. If you're doing this kind of work and it's practical, and it really is serious, not rhetoric and slogans, you find people who think of themselves as moderates and conservatives, small business people, who say that's a good thing to do at the local level. These are not the national ideologues. And you find people, that's an intelligent, people working hard. They're trying to better the neighborhood, trying to better themselves. They're doing productive work. That's a good idea. And we're surprised at how you break through ideologies if it's practical.
Now the critique of Cleveland model and co-ops is somewhat a little bit what we talked about, the limits of Mondragon, which is it's good for the people that are working there.
Right.
But it's not transformative to the city, to the state, and it doesn't change who has power. Like, you still have, you know, a tiny handful of people and or corporations that control the commanding heights of the economy.
Absolutely.
And thus have control the commanding heights of the politics. And the basic structures don't change. So mm-hmm. even if these are kind of, you know, nice shape of things to come, to be transformative, something at the political level has to happen. You really have to change who has power.
Absolutely. I totally agree with you. These are, at this stage, I think, as I'm a historian and a political economist, you don't talk about any of this without throwing some decades on the table. At this stage, we're developing the new models, and we are. That's because of the context. The reason this is happening is because of the economic pain coming out of stalemate and stagnation. And you can't get the old liberal programs passed. There's no money. So people
There is the money. They just won't tax it.
Well, they won't tax it, yes, yeah. In theory, but you can't get it. The labor unions are not powerful enough to support liberal candidates. The whole thing is what used to be possible is no longer possible. So the pain levels are growing, and it's either go in this new direction or it gets worse. You're absolutely right, though. The next stage is whether or not a political component begins to pick up on that and begin talking seriously about city government.
And there are some signs of that, too. I mean, there's some places where you have these kind of, you know, I don't know too much about it, but I've heard in Richmond, California, you have a green mayor, and they're using eminent domain to stop foreclosures. There's a sort of progressive agenda has been elected in Jackson, Mississippi.
Yes.
I don't know how it's going, but the program they got elected on looked pretty good.
No, but it's very interesting. And again, as a historian, you're beginning to see this pop up. Oh, the light bulb's going on. Here's all this experimentation and economics, and that is happening, even though the press doesn't cover it. It's really out there. Website, by the way, community-wealth.org. Really check it out because it just covers this stuff. But at some places you're seeing, oh, the next step, we're going to have to start talking about city government. And that is beginning to be experimented. We'll have some failures, we'll have some successes, and we'll learn the next step in other places. I've been cautious about this, but I think this may be the most important time in American history, bar none, and I would include the revolution, because I think we're running to the end of the possibilities available in the current structure, and people are being forced to innovate and think through vision and get serious about this stuff rather than rhetorical.
Well, if necessity is the mother of invention, we should be living in interesting times.
Exactly.
And that's all the time we have this week. This is Don saying, eyes open, minds on.
If you wish to make an apple pie from scratch, you must first invent the universe.
Thanks for listening. Having trouble finding affordable fresh baked goods and coffee? Come down to Agora Cafe located in the McMillan building at UBC. There's also space available to study.
Magazine has been supporting local music for over 30 years. Thanks to the long-term support of the Rickshaw Theater, Discorder lives. Your favorite bands are playing at the Rickshaw Theater. Check out their calendar just behind the cover of Discorder magazine or at rickshawtheater.com.
Hello there, this is Textbook. Boy, do I have a show.